Melissa Way is the next presenter. She's actually an MD-MPH student in her fourth year at Oregon Health Science University. And Melissa is going to be presenting information on vitamin D and its relationship to colorectal adenomas and some meta-analyses. Also, Melissa is one of four students who are recipients of the EpiSection Student Award based on her excellent abstract. Melissa?
Hello. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Cancer Epidemiology Seminar. So I'm Melissa Way, and today I'm presenting our research group's work on vitamin D and colorectal adenomas. So I have no relationships to disclose. So first, to place you in the context of this study, I would like to emphasize the public health significance of studying colorectal cancer. Colorectal cancer is a leading cause of cancer mortality and in the United States and in many Western countries. In 2008, an estimated 9% of cancer deaths will be due to colon cancer. However, there are also many factors that are considered important in the pathogenesis, and in terms of public health significance, there are many opportunities for cancer prevention. In this slide, we have estimated 70% of deaths preventable by dietary factors. So the dietary factor of focus for this study is vitamin D. And in this slide is the initial hypothesis for the connection between vitamin D and colon cancer. So this is a map of the United States age-adjusted colon cancer mortality, with red showing higher rates of colon cancer deaths and blue showing lower rates. So we see higher colon cancer mortality in the northeastern area of the United States. And superimposed on this map, we see contours of solar radiation. And we note patterns that there is less solar radiation in the northeastern part of the United States. And in addition, there's acid rain, thicker ozone layer, tall buildings, and many things that would prevent one from getting adequate solar radiation. And hence was the hypothesis that there's a connection between vitamin D and colon cancer mortality. So since then, many studies have been conducted to study vitamin D and the connection between colorectal cancer. We've known that there's a receptor, vitamin D receptor, present in basically all tissues of the body, and also in colon and rectum. And in addition, the enzyme 1-alpha-hydroxylase, which converts the stored form of vitamin D to the active form, is also present in virtually all cell tissues. In terms of mechanisms for colorectal cancer, just in very simple terms, decreasing cell proliferation in the epithelium, inducing differentiation in colorectal cell cultures, and inducing apoptosis in colorectal tumor and adenoma cell lines. So many prior studies have been conducted to show the association between colorectal cancer and vitamin D. And this is a study, a meta-analysis by our group that shows on the x-axis we have mean total dietary vitamin D intake, and on the y-axis the odds ratio of colorectal cancer. And all of the studies showed an inverse relationship. And with a linear extrapolation, we showed that there's about a 50% reduction in colon cancer with 950 international units of vitamin D per day. So this is dietary vitamin D. There have also been studies on serum 25-hydroxy vitamin D, which would include diet as well as the vitamin D that you synthesize from the sun. And this is a meta-analysis from our study group showing, once again on the x-axis, the mean serum 25-hydroxy vitamin D and odds ratio of colorectal cancer on the y-axis. And once again, there's an inverse linear dose relationship with half of cancer deaths projected with vitamin D levels of 38 nanograms per milliliter. So now just that's background of vitamin D and colorectal cancer, and the focus of our study was colorectal adenomas. And why would you study adenomas? Well, first of all, they're the precursors to many colorectal cancers, and they can also be detected decades earlier compared to cancer. And so this is a diagram of the progression from normal epithelium to carcinoma, and throughout the progression, you go from early adenomas to intermediate to late forms, and during that time, there are a lot of changes in DNA that occur, and it is thought that vitamin D has a role in, hopefully, a few of these stages, and this is what we are studying. So we conducted a meta-analysis and did a data search with published studies, search terms on the bottom, vitamin D, and the various names of the metabolites, along with colorectal adenoma and polyps. And inclusion criteria for this analysis included vitamin D in quantiles, or at minimum high versus low vitamin D. And studies must have also adjusted for age, given the increase in adenomas with age, as well as sex. And additional covariates were included in the analysis when they were provided. So for vitamin D intake, there were 13 studies, and for serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D, 7 studies total. We were also interested in calcium, given its intricate relationship with vitamin D, and we studied these when data were available. So the classification of vitamin D, we looked at intake, which includes dietary vitamin D, such as from fortified foods and salmon. We also looked at supplemental intake, which includes that from multivitamins and vitamin D supplements. And we also looked at the total intake, which was the sum of the two, diet and supplements. We also looked at circulating 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which is plasma, in the plasma or serum. And we looked at the stored form of vitamin D because it is a more better indicator of vitamin D status compared to the active form. And that should say 125-OH2 vitamin D, which is the active form. It's highly regulated in the body, so it's not the best measure of vitamin D status. So we conducted a statistical analysis. In the summary odds ratio, we used Pareto's assumption-free method. We did a pooling of studies when they stratified by covariates. And for modeling, we considered fixed effects and random effects. Similar between the two, and we settled on random effects for the final result. We also assessed for homogeneity using Dersimonian layered. And when heterogeneity was suggested, we did a sensitivity analysis. We also looked at the I-squared statistic for heterogeneity. We also assessed for publication bias using funnel plots, although we recognize limitations for funnel plots in small studies. And finally, all of these analyses were done using Review Manager by the Cochrane Collaboration. So the results of our study are on the next few slides. So this is a forest plot with the 12 included studies on the right side. They're in order of weight. And then on the left, we see the odds ratios and 95% confidence intervals. And this is the overall finding of an 11% decreased risk of colorectal adenoma for the highest vitamin intake compared to the lowest vitamin D intake. And this is just from dietary sources alone. So we also looked at circulating 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which captures that from the sunlight as well. And we found a stronger association with about 30% decreased risk of adenoma. Once again, we have the seven studies on the right in order of weight and the odds ratio and 95% confidence interval. And we found a 30% decreased risk. Also, when available, we looked at advanced adenomas and recurrent adenomas. And as you can see, there are 2 to 4 studies, so it's very limited. But of importance, we found there was a very strong inverse association, especially for the advanced adenomas that was present in vitamin D intake and circulating 25-hydroxyvitamin D. So just to summarize our results, we had a meta-analysis of circulating 25-hydroxyvitamin D with a 30% decreased risk of colorectal cancer that was statistically significant for the highest versus lowest quantiles of 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And also for vitamin D intake, we had an 11% marginally decreased risk of colorectal adenoma, and this was for diet alone. We also found strong inverse associations for advanced and recurrent colorectal adenomas, but the studies were limited. And finally, while I didn't mention this in our slides, our paper is coming out, and we did a more detailed explanation of the role of calcium, given its independent and joint effects with colorectal adenomas and cancer. And basically, we found a stronger association among those with high calcium intake compared to low calcium intake. But the protective effect of vitamin D was present among those with both high and low calcium intake. So for limitations of the study, first of all, we cannot exclude residual confounding, such as skin pigmentation. Darker skinned individuals require longer periods of time in the sun to synthesize the same amount of vitamin D. Dietary and lifestyle factors, such as aspirin use, folate, physical activity, smoking, as well as adiposity, with vitamin D being a fat-soluble vitamin, potential sequestration of vitamin D in adipose tissue. And so these confounding factors would mainly affect the dietary studies, but serum would be less affected. Also, second limitation, we looked at high versus low vitamin D, and it would be nice to look at each quantile and show an linear dose response relationship for individual quantiles, but we had the highest versus lowest. And A third limitation is that we had a single measure of circulating 25-hydroxyvitamin D, so it's a harder assessment to say that this is long-term status. And so overall, there could also be more studies on characterizations of adenomas, including the size and the location and the recurrence, and also given the importance of the role of calcium and vitamin D in colorectal adenomas in cancer, it would be important to study this. So the overall public health significance of this study is that this contributes to growing knowledge of vitamin D in the relationship with adenomas in cancer. And so we found a stronger association for serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D. So does this mean that there's no role for vitamin D in the diet? We know that vitamin D is uncommon in food sources. It's basically in fortified milk and dairy products and cold water fatty fish like salmon, tuna, mackerel. However, in our study, it's also important that vitamin D was assessed over a long period of time, such as in the nurses study by O. There was about 20 years of intake captured through multiple questionnaires, multiple years. So it's a measure of long-term status. And we know that the latency period for colorectal adenomas and cancers can be decades. So it's very important still. And are supplements effective then if it's not common in the diet? Well, vitamin D is also synthesized through solar radiation exposure, but if you live in a region that is not very high in sunlight or if it's winter periods of time, there can be variable amount of sun exposure. So supplements are important, and there are different types of supplements. Vitamin D3 is more, it's better in maintaining your vitamin D stores compared to D2. And so what is the recommended daily intake is what everyone wants to know, and or what should be the recommended daily intake of vitamin D. So on the x-axis here are the international units of vitamin D per day, and there's you can see there's a huge range. On the right side is the recommended daily intake for adults, 400 IUs per day for adults, and 600 IUs per day for elderly individuals. Earlier I mentioned that about 950 international units per day was associated with half the risk of colorectal cancer, and then 2,000 IUs per day is the safe upper limit, and 10,000 IUs per day is the amount that your body would make if you're sitting out in the sun. And so this is a physiologic amount, so it hasn't been shown to have toxicity. And so there's a huge range, and the studies on toxicity were, remember there was a person who took millions of IUs per day because it accidentally wasn't diluted. So basically there's a huge range in terms of vitamin D recommendations, and what we're recommending right now is very low compared to what could be potentially beneficial, and it's much lower compared to what we consider dangerous or toxic. So thank you for listening to my talk, and if you have any questions, good. Yes. So the question was, given all the different studies and meta-analyses on vitamin D and colorectal cancer and cancers in general, how do you know which is the right study and how do you know what recommendations to make? Well, I personally would like to look at the details of each of the studies, and you would want to look at the strengths of the study. You want to look at the limitations of the study, and then you want to look at basic methodology when you're considering studies and what each study brings in. Like, for example, certain limitations of meta-analyses would include the number of studies. Did they include all of the studies? What covariates were considered? Did they look at serum 25 hydroxy vitamin D? Did they, basically a lot of limitations and strengths. I think Ed Gorham also wants to help me here.
Well, I think that's an excellent answer. You're exactly right, Melissa. Another thing, especially with the enhanced group, that you want to pay attention to are the matching criteria, because season is such an overwhelming confounder, and it adds so much noise to the relationship. And there are, unfortunately, some studies that are coming out of enhanced where they don't match the cases and controls by season. And even so, there's a suggestion of a protective effect, but it's difficult for that protective association to come through the noise of seasonality. And it's been a problem with these authors. We have a letter to JNCI to answer that question. And if there is a suggestion of equivocal results, it may be due to the design. It's very important to match by season.
Yes, and I would like to add that the studies in this analysis did adjust by month of blood draw or seasonality. Yes, in the pink.
In terms of the studies that you did on dietary intake, the studies you looked at, how concerned were you? Was that self-report of dietary intake, and how did that impact your studies?
Yes, one of the common forms of assessing vitamin D intake is food frequency questionnaires, and this can capture vitamin D intake through self-report over an extended period of time, and that's one of the benefits in a lot of the studies, such as the O study, that's about 20 years of vitamin D captured.
So you felt that self-report did not introduce any?
There are a lot of studies on like validity of food frequency questionnaire that Walt Willett does, and it depends also, but the food frequency questionnaire is a valid questionnaire of dietary intake. Cedric Garland.
Thank you, Melissa. Wonderful presentation. Just a quick question about the methods. Just two points. One is that, fortunately, 25-OHD provides a method other than self-report to determine diet, which is always good to self-report anyway. A state-of-the-art system, the review manager at Oxford University, meta-analysis. Would you mind just in a moment telling us what you think some of the advantages of using this state-of-the-art method, which may not have been used by other investigators?
Well, basically, you can use various statistical analyses in a very user-friendly package system. It allows you to look at fixed effects, random effects. It allows you to look at funnel plots. It allows you to easily include and exclude studies when you're doing a sensitivity analysis. It gives you things as the I-squared statistic, which is important for assessing heterogeneity and homogeneity of studies, which is important when you're pooling studies. So a lot of advantages. Yes?
My name is Douglas Spiegel. I'm a physician at Massachusetts.
Oh, nice.
Sustaining a level, blood level of 25 hydroxy with the amount of period of time comparing D2 to D3, and I won't go into the details, but we found that they were equivalent. And I also have been prescribing both D3 and D2 to patients in my clinical practice. I just want to report that.
Oh, sorry, so you're, just so I understand, so you're finding that they're equivalent?
They're equivalent.
Okay. So there's been, actually this is an interest of mine, there have been a lot of studies on D3 and D2 looking at different levels from 50,000, which a study showed was more effective in maintaining 25-hydroxy. There have also been studies on like 14,000 over 14 days, and I know that Michael Hollick came out with a paper in 2008 showing equivocality of these studies. And so D3 is, in the past, studies have shown that it's about 3 to 4 times more effective in maintaining levels. And I think it's important to understand like how long the study was conducted, who was involved in the study, pigmentation. Maybe I'll talk to you about this afterward, because I think this is a very interesting point to bring up. Thanks. Yes. So the question was, we had some heterogeneity in the study, and when that was present, what did we do? So in the vitamin D intake, those studies were pretty homogeneous, but in the serum 25 studies, there was a little bit of heterogeneity. And so after that, we did a sensitivity analysis, and we excluded the most heterogeneous study to make the I-squared statistic zero. And after that, there was still an inverse dose response with vitamin D being protective. And so I have detailed results on the sensitivity analysis if you want to read our paper that's coming out. But yes, we did.
Any other questions for Melissa?
Yes. Yes, so the question was on, if you live at a certain latitude, we are told that about 15 minutes of sunlight, is that adequate? And are there studies on amount of time depending on skin pigmentation and other factors? If that's right. So yes, we do know that darker pigmented individuals require maybe 10 times as long in the sun to get the same amount, because melanin blocks the vitamin D synthesis. And also elderly individuals require longer periods of time in the sun. And in addition to latitude, there are other factors such as acid rain, the thickness of the ozone layer. If you live in a metropolitan area, there are tall buildings and overall less solar radiation in that area. So yes, a lot of other factors. I think, did you have a question? Are there any other questions? Okay, I think that's the time. Thanks.
Dr. Kenneth.